There's the big board, the 20 electoral votes from the state of Pennsylvania. We just got new metrics in.
The inauguration of a president celebrates a peaceful transition of power engineered by the American voters.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th listeners. It is great to be back. Rabia here, and I'm here this week with Siraj. How are you, Siraj?
I'm doing well, Rabia. And yourself?
I'm good. It's been a tough week, I think, for the country.
Week from now, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's been, it feels like it's been, I don't know, like, and I'm talking specifically about the terrible tragedy in Las Vegas. I call it a tragedy, but it was, you know, actual planned out violence. But it feels like it's been longer than a week. It feels like, I don't know. Yeah, maybe because of the news cycle.
Even months. I mean, and the fact that we still don't know a motive is just, there's just so many questions that remain unanswered.
Yeah, I think this is, it's a really fascinating story about like what propelled this guy to do it. But we're going to talk in depth about that entire incident and then all the other issues related to it later in this show. But we're going to start off with a couple of other kind of shorter, quick stories that kind of caught our eye this week. And I'll start off. I honestly have been waiting for Tillerson to resign for quite a while, and I thought this would be the week it happens.
Why for a while?
Why for a while? Because I feel like there are so many times that Trump has undermined him publicly. There are times when Trump has made all kinds of these foreign policy announcements and Tillerson's office has no idea. Tillerson has no idea. And then most recently, earlier in this past week, I think Tillerson was overseas and Trump said, he like literally tweeted at Tillerson, but not really, and saying, Tillerson, don't bother to negotiate about North Korea.
He subtweeted him.
He tweeted
about him without mentioning or his handle. I don't even know if Tillerson tweets. But anyways, back to your story.
Yeah, I don't think Tillerson tweets. But the point is that he, I mean, like, that is not the way for a president to maybe communicate with his Secretary of State. But that's what he did. And I thought, this is it. This is probably the moment that Tillerson's like, F this shit. Excuse my language. But then the story came out about that, and I was a little bit off the grid for about 24 hours, and I come back, and there's all this hoopla about somebody being called a moron. And then, do you know how that happened? Did that happen after that subtweet?
I think it happened actually during the summer.
And oh.
That's what the report is coming out. Sources are saying that. And Tillerson actually denied that he called Trump a moron. And another source said he's actually right. Like, Tillerson actually did not call Trump a moron. He called him, and I quote, pardon my French, he called him a fucking imbecile.
Oh, that's so much better. That's so much better.
And I don't like to curse, but like, I mean, you know, people have like commended me on the podcast for not cursing, but I use that in context for our listeners as a quote.
That's okay. Susan and I are here to make up the cursing quota. We have no problem with that.
You guys are nasty women, as Trump would say.
No, you did not go there. Now I'm gonna have to get one of those
t-shirts.
You're
gonna have to body check me.
I will. And I would be afraid if I was you. But anyway, so when he went up there, I actually was at the U.S. Capitol when Tillerson gave his speech this week. Maybe you know Imam Abdullah Antepli. He's an imam from Turkey. He works at Duke University, one of their first Muslim chaplains. And he actually delivered a Muslim prayer at the U.S. House of Representatives. So I accompanied him. I was lucky enough to be invited to witness this, and I've never seen it. Paul Ryan was there presiding quickly. He crossed himself before the imam gave his talk.
In case he was taking shahada beforehand.
In case he converted accidentally or something. Anyway, but as this was happening, I couldn't even concentrate because I didn't have my phone. And right before we walked into the chambers, Tillerson had gotten up on the podium to make his statement. And I really thought, this is going to be the moment he goes, I'm out. But he was just, it was afterwards when I reviewed it, I'm like, oh, he was just begging for his job. Isn't that what happened?
I think. You know, there's just so many things going on, and I was missing the tail end of that prayer that he was giving.
Did you see it?
No, I didn't see it.
Oh, yeah, it's on C-SPAN.
Oh,
you can catch
it
there. Yeah, so, I'll tweet out the link.
So back to Tillerson. And for one, congratulations on getting off the grid for 24 hours. I wish I had such luxuries. But with Tillerson, you know, there are reports coming out that he has like a suicide pact with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly and Defense Secretary Jim Mad Dog Mattis. Those two individuals are the real ones who are protecting Tillerson from really getting Trump's wrath. And I can't imagine, it's surprising that Tillerson hasn't resigned in light of, you know, every other individual who has left the White House or left the cabinet. You know, Tom Price left the week prior.
But the circumstances of those leavings were kind of different, I feel. Like, Tom Price was, like, publicly humiliated. Like, he was caught doing things he shouldn't be doing.
Tillerson's been publicly humiliated.
But not in the same way. Like, Tillerson's only... His humiliation is at the hands of Trump, not necessarily that he has been, like, he's under investigation for anything wrong, he's done anything illegal. There's nothing like that. But he, you know, and I wonder when you talk about the suicide pact, like, these other gentlemen, and what I understand about them is they're highly respected, they're really smart, and I really feel like they're hanging in there for the sake of the country.
They're the most respected individuals in the Trump cabinet and administration, John Kelly and Jim Mattis. You know, even with Sessions, I mean, Sessions, we thought he offered his resignation, or at least reports said he offered his resignation, and Trump declined it. And yet Trump has not stopped tweeting about him and, you know, voicing his displeasure over Sessions' recusal in the Russia investigation.
Right.
What will be the straw that breaks the camel's back for Tillerson and Trump's relationship? Do you think this is it? I mean, like, is it going to reveal, like, on, you know, Sunday night, Monday morning that, you know, that Tillerson is out and he's had enough of this?
You know, I don't know what would be the straw that breaks the back here, but I will say that Tillerson might also be one of those patriots who's like, I'm hanging in by my fingernails for the sake of this country. I'm not going to let this guy do this to me. But it could be, and, you know, we can jump ahead a little bit, but it could be the straw that breaks us all is this storm that Trump keeps saying is coming our way, that I have a feeling Tillerson knows nothing about. And for the folks who haven't caught this, I think twice now, Trump, and so there was like a, he had an event at the White House. He had all these military officers and his spouses, and they had dinner together. And then they had this big photo op, you know, tons of people standing the picture. And Trump makes his comment. Let's listen to the audio here.
Trump hosted the country's top military commanders and their partners last night at the White House for dinner. The gathering came amid concerns about tensions with North Korea and the Iran nuclear deal. During a photo op in the White House dining room, President Trump made this puzzling comment.
You guys know what this represents?
And now the president was asked again what he meant by calm before the storm, and he responded, you'll find out. The White House has not clarified the comments further. Mr. Trump faces an October 15th deadline on the Iran nuclear deal. He is expected to refuse to certify that Iran is in compliance.
No, I don't know. What he was talking about. And then he was asked again about it later, I think. And I don't know if his press secretary was asked about it. And she was, actually. And she said, Huckabee Sanders, she said, you'll just have to wait and see. And so I'm just wondering if we're all going to die thanks to North Korea. Like, what's happening? What do you think he's hitting at? Do you think he's hitting, it's Iran or North Korea? It's one of the two, right?
Well, Iran, the review process for the Iran nuclear deal is coming up. The deadline, I believe, is this coming week in mid-October. To certify whether Iran is being compliant in the non-proliferation treaty or whatever you want to call it. I think Trump, obviously, there are reports coming out that Trump is going to decertify that.
He said it. He said he might.
Yeah. I think he will, so that he could try to renegotiate for a better deal in his mind.
You might be right.
I don't think he wants to go to war with Iran. But if he did, he has the backing of the Saudi government because of his recent Saudi trip this year. I believe that was in May. And they had
the Gulf states, all the Gulf states.
Gulf states. They had that little summit in Riyadh where every nation except, I believe, for Iran was invited. Fancy that. And I don't know if Qatar was there, but, you know, Trump has been pretty strict and stern with Qatar.
Yeah, Qatar's not in a good spot right now.
But, you know, back on North Korea with the quiet storm.
Let me just say quickly about Iran, though. My understanding is that they actually have been complying with all the requirements of the agreement. So that's a hard sell to say. Like, it's one thing if they weren't, right? And then you could say, well, this deal is not working for us. But I know that Trump is critical of the deal itself. He just feels like it's way too complacent. It still gives them space to, like, develop nuclear capabilities. But it's interesting because I read reports this week that Israeli leadership is actually saying that, you know what, like, leave this deal in place. And you would think, I mean, like, a lot of times Israel's relationship with Iran or lack thereof, you know, is cited as a reason to be really tough on Iran. And in this case, you have reports that Israel's like, nope, I think we're good.
I actually haven't seen that report. That's completely new to me. But that if that is true, you know, that's obviously very surprising considering the fact that it's, you know, Bibi Netanyahu who came to the United States to speak in front of Congress against former President Obama's wishes and basically criticized the negotiation process on the Iran nuclear deal. I will say, though, that, you know, I think Trump probably will decertify it. And, you know, we're recording on Sunday. Just, you know, a few hours ago, Trump was tweeting about Senator Bob Corker from Tennessee, who's going to retire at the end of his term in 2018. I don't know if he realizes it, that, you know, the Senate has only 52 Republicans in it. And the more Republicans he alienates, the less likely he is to get any, you know, push for reform, say, for example, tax reform, which is the on the top of his legislative agenda right now. And
it's his next big legislative failure. Let's just
and I'm just using that as an example to say that, you know, Trump, while we think he might do the statesman or diplomatic thing, you know, he still remains a wild card. And there, I know he's like, I know a lot of people, a lot of Trump supporters voted for him to, you know, shake up the system. And, you know, they seem to be getting what they wanted in terms of shaking up the system. It seems like everything that he's doing, or most things that he's doing, I should say, are not only just shaking up the GOP, but shaking pretty much everything that his predecessors have put in place. But to answer your question on the quiet storm, I think he's referring to North Korea.
I think he is.
I mean, the whole subtweet with Tillerson talking, you know, about don't worry about negotiations. You know, on Saturday, he was tweeting about, you know, there's only one thing that'll work. And what is that one thing that we haven't tried with North Korea, with the exception of what we did in the 1950s? And that's probably has to do with military intervention. And if Trump takes this country to war, I can tell you.
What are we going to do? Are we going to occupy North Korea? How would this work? I feel like he's so trigger happy. Or maybe the plan is to take out some like targets and try.
There was a CNN report that, you know, said that South Korea was planning an assassination attempt on Kim Jong-un, which is funny because, you know.
I want to keep that under wraps.
Yeah. And CNN is like, okay, I guess we'll run with this story then. And then the idea that the policy that came forward, or policy proposal, I should say, when Trump was on the campaign trail of arming South Korea and Japan with nuclear weapons, obviously that's a horrible idea. I don't know if that's something he originally thought of, or if it was someone within his circle of advisors or anyone in his cabinet who was like, you know what, this sounds like a good idea. It definitely is not. And I can tell you, and I don't know how this will affect his base, because his base is, you know, for the most part, stuck with him, even on the DACA.
Right.
What was it? The DACA move where he, you know, capitulated to Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. You know, a lot of people in his base started to drift off, but, you know, some are coming back.
Didn't he just tweet the other day that he reached out to, I think, Schumer to talk about healthcare? I'm like, what is even happening here? But okay.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's trying to make the, I'm telling you, I've been saying it for weeks. He's trying his darndest to make the GOP establishment look terrible and make them completely inept in terms of governance, that Republican voters and Trump supporters have no choice but to primary them in the 2018 midterms to get more pro-Trump Republicans in the House and Senate.
This is the brilliant thing about Trump. No matter what, he wins. I mean, that's how I see it. I'm like, you know, all of his policy agenda items fail, he still wins. I mean, either way, it's because he never has, and nobody ever, I mean, his base will not assign responsibility to him. He does not take responsibility. He doesn't show leadership on any of these things in terms of like trying to actually, you know, he just says, go do this and do it. And, you know, and there's that's it. And then when they fail, because of course they're going to fail when it's like that, then he's like, well, not my problem.
Angular Cassis Opulent. If you aren't familiar with those wine terms, congratulations, you're just like me. I don't care if wine clubs and critics babble on about herbaceousness, I just want to know, does it taste good? Luckily, I found First Leaf, the only wine club that's based on your tastes. I just received my First Leaf order, and these are some damn good wines. Here's how it works. Customize your first leaf order by selecting the color, wine regions, and frequency of your wine shipments. First Leaf then creates an introductory 3-pack of wine to get you started, and I can tell you, they're quite earthy. With First Leaf's introductory pack, you'll get all three for just $5 each. Normally, these bottles of wine go for $20 each, if not more. When your bottles arrive, rate the wine to get personalized selections based on your unique tastes. The more wines you rate, the better your recommendations will be. First Leaf eliminates the middleman and works directly with the world's foremost wineries in France, Italy, and Napa Valley. First Leaf is my new favorite way to rate and buy quality wine. To order your 3-pack of introductory wine for $15, go to tryfirstleaf.com/45th. That's 3 bottles of wine for only $15 at tryfirstleaf.com/45th. Experience First Leaf today at tryfirstleaf.com/45th.
So let's move on. I want you to talk about this because this was an issue that you brought up. And we just hit a very important anniversary the other day.
So 1-year anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape being released during the 2016 election, courtesy of Dave Fahrenthold, who Washington Post reporter. Of course, if you haven't heard of the Access Hollywood tape.
Whoa. I did try and she was married.
That's huge news, Sarah.
No, Nancy. Yeah. No, this was marriages. And I moved on her very heavily. In fact, I took her out furniture shopping. She wanted to get some furniture. I said, I'll show you where they have some nice furniture. I took out furniture. I moved on her like a bitch. I've got to use some Tic Tacs just in case I start kissing her. You know, I'm automatically attracted to beautiful. I just start kissing them. It's like a magnet. You just kiss. I don't even wait. And when you're a star, they let you do it. You can do anything.
Whatever you want.
Grab them by the I can do anything.
You know, I read that, I don't know starting when, but at some point they were going to like blast that audio 24 hours in front of the White House. It might have been on the anniversary.
Yeah. So it was October 7th. Recording on October 8th. So it was around, you know, Friday, Saturday that they were just replaying it at the National Mall over by the Washington Monument. But the reason
is there are children around that want to do that. you don't want to let the kids hear how the president talks. But anyway,
I know. Well, that's the whole reason why this matters, right?
Right. So tell us what happened on the anniversary.
So, you know, I bring up the 1-year anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape because of what we've seen just in the past week out of Hollywood. So, you know, President Trump, he took a swipe at Hollywood producer, mega producer Harvey Weinstein on Saturday evening, saying he was, quote, not at all surprised, end quote, by revelations that the Hollywood movie mogul has repeatedly paid to settle charges of sexual harassment. Now, the timing of Trump's remarks to White House reporters in the exchange as he left for a Republican fundraiser in North Carolina was notable because they came on the anniversary of the Access Hollywood tape from 2005, in which he, quote,
brilliant,
you know, used the, you know, very vulgar terms about, you know, grabbing and sexually assaulting women, the whole, you know, the term, again, pardon my French to listeners, but he obviously bragged about, quote, grabbing women by the pussy.
Yep.
And so that was, you know, he dismissed it as locker room talk. And, you know, for people on every end of the spectrum, with the exception of a very small few, were defending those comments.
I Kid Rock.
Well, Kid Rock was defending it. Was he? What? Again,
I don't know. I'm just guessing.
I don't know what Kid Rock's take was on all of it. I'll have to look that up. But it's notable because Trump criticizing Harvey Weinstein, who, you know, Harvey Weinstein, a lot of you know, developments have been coming out showing that, you know, he sexually harassed, sexually assaulted women, both in the industry, entertainment industry, as well as even the reporter. Who he quote, you know, and this is a story that came out yesterday, but wait, you know, maybe like, you know, 5-10 years ago, he basically masturbated in front of a reporter and
in a restaurant, in a hallway, in a restaurant.
And then ejaculated into a potted plant, which is, you know, disturbing enough for the human, but also the potted plant. I mean, that's
right.
You know, and this guy is getting lampooned, you know, potted plants are getting lampooned, but obviously, this is, you know, a terrible story about, you know, no matter where your political affiliations lie, you know, both individuals are just morally reprehensible in this regard.
Uh-huh. So this is interesting. I'm watching some of the commentary around this, and I don't think it's that much different than other kinds of scandals that spill open after many years. But I've seen male commentators saying, why did women not come forward before? And why was this so well protected? And how come he got away with this? Was that also your reaction?
Because no. My reaction,
I'm like, yeah, of course I know this shit happens, and I'm sure it happens with a lot of other
people.
No,
you know,
too.
My initial reaction was like, you know, think of all the journalists who he had on his payroll to try to keep these stories from getting out. I mean, like, if you think about it, the best thing that you can do to protect yourself is to have good PR. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, having friendly relations or even, you know, compensating journalists who are working at certain organizations who have enough power, who can nix stories about, you know, anything about Harvey Weinstein, about, you know, any bad press. And so,
well, there's that, but there's also the fact that a journalist can't really report a story if a source isn't willing to give them the information. And so Weinstein also did this where he, like, you know, he had many settlements, he paid off people, paid off victims, and that's not uncommon either.
Right. No, that's not uncommon. And again, I am not one of those people that victimizes women even further when it comes to, you know, things like sexual harassment or sexual assault, because it is a very, very difficult thing. And I, you know, back in college, I tried assisting a sexual assault victim in terms of getting her story out publicly. But the school administration was being so tough in terms of trying to flesh out the story and, you know, almost made it impossible for this victim to essentially, you know, get the type of, not just counseling, but like the justice that she wanted. And, you know, it was just a messy affair altogether. And I understand that, you know, with individuals now and victims now who are trying to come forward, it is a very, very difficult process. And I would not, you know, blame anyone or any victim who would, you know, legitimately was a victim. You know, there are cases where people are trying to just get money out of it, but that's not always the case. Most cases, I would say, there are legitimate reasons for people to come forward.
Right. And most cases are basically never reported. So, I mean, but so why did you think it was interesting that Trump tweeted? You just think it was ironic, or you think it was kind of lack of self-awareness?
Well, yeah, lack of self-awareness and just the fact that, you know, him commenting on this, you know, pot calling the kettle black. And, you know, I've tried to at least remain objective in terms of Trump's policies. But as Trump the human being, I mean, I don't think there's a single fiber in my being that would, you know, support this man morally.
Right.
Because, I mean, he has been accused of rape. He's been accused of sexual harassment. I mean,
right. It's not just the Access Hollywood comments. It's the fact that he might have engaged in some of the same kind of behavior, actually assaulting women.
And that's the only reason I bring it up, just because, you know, despite the fact that, you know, I happen to be more center right, I still can't support what this man did in his past.
Right. Well, I feel like he, in this office, he might even have less opportunity to do that kind of stuff. So in a way,
I don't know. You ask Bill Clinton.
Well, there's that. That's true. But I'm not even going to get into consent and stuff anyway. But well, you know, I applaud you that you are able to make that distinction and still, because it has been like really disheartening. And this kind of stuff sends signals all throughout society that when you have leadership that's really powerful on different levels, whether it's national, state, in congregations, even in families, you know, where a patriarch has done something, has molested young girls, but everybody kind of just hushes it up and just keeps on.
You personally have been dealing with this recently. And
yeah,
you could bring it up, but
yeah.
Siraj
is referring to, there's been recently, a couple of weeks ago, a public outing of a very well-respected American Muslim leader, male leader, also internationally known as somebody who's kind of a sexual predator, I would say. I mean, he's many other people have investigated the issue, talked to the victims, and have verified the allegations. And so I'm one of a handful of people who, like, won't stop tweeting about it and Facebooking about it, and I'm pissing people off
because
they're like, stop talking about it.
People need to know. I mean, it's sad that it happened, but the truth hurts, and people need to know the truth despite everything that they've known about a certain person. I mean, We look, you know,
people, and by the way, with this guy, people have known for years, just like with Harvey Weinstein, just like with Trump, like people have known for years about this guy too. It just recently became public. And so, but people don't want to hear it, and I'm just going to keep sharing it, and I really don't give a crap.
You know,
so
anyways, I really applaud those who are consistent on, you know, these type of issues, despite all of their, you know, personal biases. And, you know, I have to commend you, Rabia, for doing what you're doing. I also have to commend, you know, people like Lena Dunham, who I've been very critical over the last few years, being consistent on Harvey Weinstein. And I have to applaud any Republican who's been consistent on Donald Trump in terms of past behavior.
Yeah, agreed.
I just want to get that out there.
All right, sounds good. All right, so we're going to move on now to our two bigger stories we're going to talk about more in depth. And the first one is Puerto Rico. Now, when I say Puerto Rico, of course, I'm talking about Hurricane Maria and the response, the aftermath, what's been going on since then. It made landfall September 20th, so it has not been that recent, but a lot has happened in the last week or 10 days about this. And I want to talk a little bit about kind of what happened. And this is from a Washington Post report about kind of like where things seem to have gone wrong with the administration vis-a-vis the response to the immediate response to the hurricane. So apparently what happened was this hurricane makes landfall. They knew it was coming on Wednesday, September 20th. The next day, the very next day, there was some flurry of activity by the administration for one day. And then for like 4 days, Trump and his aides kind of just went dark. Trump went to New Jersey and he spent a long weekend at a private golf club. He took a quick trip to Alabama for a political rally. He loves his rallies.
Let's not forget in that time he went to war with the NFL and NBA.
That's right. That's right. But those are important pressing issues, as Puerto Rico's was pretty much wiped clean. But they didn't say anything. Trump and his senior advisor said nothing for the next 3 or 4 days. And apparently that Friday then, so a few days have gone by, he held a meeting. But at that meeting with his cabinet officials, it wasn't Puerto Rico he was talking about. He was talking mostly about the immigration travel ban, because we have a new travel ban. And then, you know, in Puerto Rico,
and that was swept under the rug, so...
Well, yeah, I mean, we have to talk about that ban too.
We'll talk about that in a bit. Let's stay on Puerto Rico.
That's not something that's going to go away. We can talk about that maybe next week, because I have a feeling this ban's not going away. Anyway, so Puerto Rico in the meantime is completely destroyed, wiped clean. And then that Monday, I think, is finally when, the following Monday is when apparently Trump gets back to the White House, and this is what really bothers him. He sees terrible press coverage. He sees that, unlike what he's been saying, which is, you know, we've been doing a great job, we're responding well, that Puerto Rico is a mess, and he doesn't like what he's seeing. And so that's when he starts like really responding in the media and kind of paying more attention to this issue. But, you know, in the meantime, like 5 days have gone by. So, and a week after the storm hit, you know, people were calling on him to waive the Jones Act, which is a law that it bars foreign vessels from like delivering aid to Puerto Rico. So a week goes by and he doesn't waive this act. And when he's finally asked, like, what are you doing? Why aren't you allowing? Because he did that for the other hurricanes. He said, well, you know, there's a lot of shippers and people in the shipping industry that didn't want it lifted. What? So anyway. But I'm going to turn it over to you to talk about the PR disaster.
Yeah. So, you know, this past week, Trump went and visited Puerto Rico. And this is, again, after the Las Vegas shooting. So he visited Puerto Rico on Tuesday, and he visited Las Vegas on Wednesday.
He was in his finest hurricane year. Yeah, so, I saw him in Melania.
And this is the thing. And honestly, after the Las Vegas shooting, I thought, wow, is Trump going to push back his trip to Puerto Rico or even cancel altogether to go to Las Vegas? And I was actually surprised that he didn't. I actually thought, you know, it's actually probably a good thing he stuck with his plans to go to Puerto Rico. However, when he got there, things were a little bit strange, and he made his first appearance in Puerto Rico ever. I don't think he ever campaigned there, because, you know, they don't have any electoral votes, so why bother, right?
Bother, yep.
But, you know, the biggest problem that happened was, you know, in the lead up, he ended up, you know, going in this little political fight with San Juan Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz.
And right. It had been ongoing.
Mm-hmm. It's been ongoing. You know, and just to give you some context, you know, Mayor Cruz gave a few interviews, and one shirt she wore, I believe it was on CNN, said, "Help us, or we're dying," or something of that nature. And then she was very critical of the president in the press conference. And, you know, Trump you know, basically responded.
But she didn't call him out specifically. She just said, we think this is not a good news story. Things are not good here. It's
I'm not exactly, I can't recall all the comments she said, but I recall that I remember her saying, you know, I didn't want to do this, but I feel like I need to. And, you know, that's when she basically called out the Trump administration for not doing enough. And essentially, that drew the ire of President Trump, who that weekend then tweeted about her and saying that the Democrats told her to be nasty to Trump, so she's being nasty.
And that she's showing poor leadership. And
she's showing poor leadership. And then, you know, and then in a follow-up interview, and this is just weird because, you know, the San Juan mayor, Mayor Cruz, was saying, like, this is not about politics. And then she wore a shirt, like, after Trump's tweets with a, you know, customized shirt that said nasty on it during the interview. And you're like, well, okay.
Wasn't that after his visit to Puerto Rico, though? Or what? It was after his visit to Puerto Rico, I think so. Yeah. And so we also have to talk about, like, what he said during that.
So I want to get, I was just providing some context that, you know, he was already beefing with the San Juan mayor. So, like, what could possibly go right? And of course, nothing really did, because when he went down there and, you know, he talked about the Hurricane Maria not being a real catastrophe.
Now, I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack, because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the, every death is a horror. But if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this. Now, what is your death count as of this moment? 17?
16 certified.
16 people certified. 16 people versus in the thousands. You can be very proud of all of your people, all of our people working together.
So he says it's not a real catastrophe. You know, compares it to Hurricane Katrina, and like compares the death toll. Like, but like, of course, when comparing disasters, it's apples to oranges. It's always a unique situation. And then, of course, the beautiful, beautiful photo op that he had of him tossing paper towels into a crowd like they were,
you know, basketballs. I watched that at least 5 times, because I kept thinking,
I had to lampoon it.
You did?
I made a video for our site, Red Alert Politics, of just syncing up the video of him shooting the paper towels with this rap song called Flick of the Wrist. Like, look at the flick of the wrist, that wrist. And that was essentially the video.
We will have to tweet that out for our listeners.
I will.
But you know what I was trying to do is I kept trying to look at the faces in the audience, because the video is from the back. Like, the video I saw is from the back of him. I think there's also one shot from the side, but I kept it was almost like he thought he was doing layups on a court. And I wanted to look at the faces in the crowd at what is happening here. Like, maybe I'm missing something. Maybe this is like, they're like loving it. He thinks he's at a concert. But I did not see a lot of smile. I thought people looked a little bit shocked and weirded out.
Yeah, I mean, there were a few photo ops of him actually posing with individuals, not at that particular center. I mean, he was going out taking photos with survivors.
He has serious issues, and because he has no way to relate to any of, I think he lacks complete and utter human empathy to begin with, but he has no way in his lifetime and his experience to relate to people in these situations. I mean, how many times has he visited a shelter and said, have a good time, folks, have a great time? Like, he's done this repeatedly. Right. He has said to people in shelters, have a great time, repeatedly. Now, after that, that paper towel incident, you know, of course, people are like, oh, my God, what is he doing? And so he caught on to the criticism. And so he had an interview with Arkansas governor, or former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, the other night. And this is, I got to read this quote, because I was like, this is crazy. This is what he said about that. He goes, quote, they had these beautiful, soft towels, very good towels. And I came in there and there was a crowd of a lot of people and they were screaming and they were loving everything again. He thinks they're having a good time. I was having fun. They were having fun. They said, throw them to me. Throw them to me, Mr. President, Trump said before pantomiming, shooting a basketball in the same way he tossed up paper towels. He thinks these are parties going on, I think.
I don't know if, I can't recall.
Don't say defense.
What do you mean? I'm not going to say in
his defense. I thought you were going to say in his defense.
No, I was just going to say that I'm trying to recall his response to when he went down to Houston. Because at Houston, that was a PR disaster too, because he didn't pose with any of the victims. And then I believe he went down to, you know, South Florida, where there was a lot of, you know, damage from Hurricane Irma. And it was a much, I think that was probably his best visit, because he, you know, it was fresh off of the Houston visit, in which he didn't pose with anyone, and he just basically gave like a campaign rally. I think in Florida, he actually started helping out with like lifting stuff and putting stuff in trucks and like putting water bottles, and then, you know, posing with a lot of survivors. And, you know, Florida, we don't remember as well, because that actually was pretty much standard for the presidential visit to a disaster area should be. It's just that we remember Houston and we remember Puerto Rico so well because they were just so ridiculous, because it's not what a president should be doing when they're visiting a disaster region. So I'm not saying in his defense, but I mean, I feel like he forgot his advisors, you know, telling him, this is what you should be doing. Do not do this. And then he went and did that.
That list would be so long, Siraj. Imagine. Do not throw relief supplies at people. Do not pretend this is a party. Do not like dance. Don't tell women they're beautiful. Grab nobody by the pussy. I mean, it would be so long list.
If he danced in Puerto Rico, I got to give that man props, because, you know.
Wait a minute. Did you hear him actually when he came back from Puerto Rico?
Oh, yeah, I did.
Oh, my God. I want to die.
Oh, that was just funny. That was, I mean, like, objectively, that was funny.
You guys just Google it. Trump Spanish accent Puerto Rico. Just Google it, and you're going to watch this man.
Puerto Rico. So he tried to say it like that, and everybody in the room laughed. And it was a White House event marking the Hispanic Heritage Month. But one thing I will say, and this, you know, kind of struck me as, you know, a little bit cathartic, and I realized that, you know, Trump probably didn't have a White House iftar dinner during Ramadan for American Muslim leaders, because he did not want to get caught saying assalamu alaikum.
I never thought about that.
It was just like, you know, he's going to
one of many reasons, but yes,
butcher it, and that's probably the reason why. So
I have a feeling, though, if he did have one, he would just be like, I ain't saying that, and that would be the end of that.
He'd probably say it in English, being peace be unto you, all of you.
Or salami salaikum.
Salami
and bacon, which we love. So let's move on a little bit from the PR issue to the actual like issue of how the administration has responded. Now, one thing, there's been a lot of criticism about how slow the response has been. And granted, there have been challenges on the ground because roads are wiped out. It's hard. One of the big things that's happening is there are actually containers of relief supplies that are just sitting that are not being distributed because they're having trouble. But having said that, part of the issue is, I think about a week ago, they were reporting that there are only 25 Army helicopters that were making these deliveries. So if you don't have the roads, we'll use helicopters. We can send in more than 25. The other thing that just happened this a couple days ago is that FEMA removed all statistics about the situation in Puerto Rico from its website, which I thought was crazy.
That's not a good sign.
Now, if people do want statistics, they can get it from, I'm going to give you the website. It's www.status.pr. And so you can go to that website, which is a Puerto Rican website. I think it's the Puerto Rican government is running that, to show statistics about how many hospitals are up and running, how many people have cell service now, how many people have electricity. But the situation is pretty dire right now.
Yeah, and it's just bad all around, because we still treat Puerto Rico as if they're not a territory of the United States. I think there's still a lot of a lot of treatment that we give to like foreign countries who kind of treat Puerto Rico like that. And I don't know. I think there was a joke circulating that Trump just found out that Puerto Rico, and I think even SNL, Saturday Night Live, made this joke about finding out that Puerto Rico was actually U.S. territory.
Yeah, I mean, I believe that. And, you know, I have read many reports. For example, I was reading a story this morning about that very disastrous PR, that meeting he did when he got there. And by the way, the mayor was there, but he totally snubbed her. But that when he, so in this report, it said that the meeting happened at an American airbase in Puerto Rico. And I thought, it's America. I mean, like it's part of the United States. It's a U.S. territory, but we keep making the distinction like as if these are two separate, national identities here. And reporters do it.
You know, and just even researching for this whole conversation, you know, there's a sort of otherness that we treat even Puerto Rico's, you know, the San Juan mayor, Carmen Cruz. I mean, she's not referred to in headlines by name. She's just referred to as San Juan mayor. And, right. You know, for the longest time, I was just like, I don't even know this person's name. And they're not even really bothering to tell me. So I'm just not going to know it.
Right. Right. It's like, so now you got to figure out what her name actually is. I bet you Trump doesn't know it either. So there's that.
I mean, I don't think he actually referred to her by name in his tweets. So that's just another like driving the narrative of that sort of otherness that we treat Puerto Rico. And, you know, it's sad. I mean, I actually... You know, what would unite the country more than making Puerto Rico the 51st state? I mean, if Trump...
You think
that
would unite the country, or would that, like, trigger, like, a civil war?
I don't think it'd trigger a civil war, no.
Well, I don't know. I think there's a big faction of the country that doesn't want any more brown people.
Like, no. You know, I think what would happen is it would trigger a lot of, you know, people like me who have obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD, about... You know, putting a 51st star on the flag, that would just like drive me nuts, because like, you know, it's 51, not 50. Like, why are we going into odd numbers and we're not, you know, it's just one of those things where like this just
wait, does DC have a star? DC doesn't have a star either. We could just like
DC does not have a star, but again,
well, there you go, make it 52.
But they're a district.
Done.
They don't have statehood.
And well, maybe they should.
And I am they're operated by the federal government, so, you know, we can get into that debate later.
Yeah.
But I will say that it's the whole situation in Puerto Rico is sad. I reserved my criticism of Trump until he actually went down there. And then his battle with the San Juan mayor, Carmen Cruz, is just, you know, despicable.
Yeah. I will say this. While I do think it's true that some lives matter less to Trump than others, I don't think that's exclusive to brown people. I think it's true for... people that he might not think matter in general, which is poor people. And I think even if he were to get the same kind of criticism like he got from Cruz, you know, by other leaders in other disaster affected areas that were mostly white areas, I think he would probably react the same way. I don't think he reserves his ire just for brown people here, though. I mean, like the devastation, I want to talk about this briefly before we move on, is pretty significant. Right now what's happened apparently, so Puerto Rico's Secretary of Agriculture said that, you know, most of their farms are like kind of wiped out. And, you know, they have plantations and agriculture around plantains, bananas, papaya, coffee, citrus crops. It's all gone. They're calling this the worst natural disaster in 100 years. One statistic says that the island has lost 80% of its crops. The poultry sector lost 90% of its production, and it lost 2 million of its 2.6 million birds. There's floods covering 51,000 acres of the coastal area. Cows and livestock have floated away. They're died, you know, drowned. Irrigation systems are lost. I mean, these are huge. They're saying, you know, tens of billions of dollars worth of damage. That is going to impact the mainland too. And I know sometimes like we don't care unless it does. But what a lot of people don't know is one of the largest export from Puerto Rico is not these agricultural crops. It's actually pharmaceuticals. Pharmaceuticals and medical devices are the island's leading exports. This is going to disrupt all of that. And, you know, federal officials and a lot of drug companies are kind of scrambling that right now, according to the New York Times, to prevent national shortages of critical drugs for treating cancer, diabetes, heart disease. And because there were 80 plants, 80 that made these medicines and medical devices in Puerto Rico, and most of them have been wiped out. So there is that. And of course, then you have the issue of dislocation. We're talking about people who've lost homes. Now, this could have an interesting impact going forward, which is the fact that thousands of Puerto Ricans are now actually coming to the mainland. They're saying they're estimating in almost 100,000 could come to Orlando, to Florida, just to get away from, you know, just to basically stabilize their lives. And that could really impact politics in Florida. What do you think about that? I thought that was really interesting.
I mean, I don't think it's a good thing that Trump wants. And like, you can't say it's like immigration because, you know, they're U.S. territory.
Right. So, you can't stop them. No ban there.
No ban there. Obviously, there could be some minor impact to the economy. But again, I mean, everyone should be allowed to move between states as they want. And if there's like a massive disaster, like what we've seen in Puerto Rico, if we saw in Houston, people are, are just going to go elsewhere and try to rebuild their lives until everything in their homeland is sort of settled, I guess. I mean, it's...
That could take a long time.
It could take a long time. But like, people move all the time. I don't think it's going to make any bigger impact if a bunch of Puerto Ricans move up to Florida or move to Texas or move to New York even. I mean, if people have been to New York, they would know that I think the single largest population of Puerto Ricans outside of Puerto Rico is in New York City. I would not even doubt for a second that a lot of them would move up there.
That's true. But when you're talking about a place like Florida, which has been instrumental in so many different races, the last two presidential and governor's races were decided by roughly one percentage point or less. So it could have an impact there.
I'm sorry. I was focusing more on like economy. But yeah, in terms of like the,
politics,
in terms of like actual presidential elections and midterm elections. It definitely could help in terms of swinging the state back to blue, which is, I'm sure what Hillary Clinton would have liked.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's see how it pans out in about a year from now. ModCloth is your go-to spot for fashion as unique as you. They believe that fashion is for every single body, size, and shape. That's why their exclusive line of apparel is offered in a full size range from extra, extra small all the way to 4X. They specialize in a broad range of styles, from quirky statement pieces, vibrant colors, retro dresses, classic silhouettes, and cool contemporary clothing. I recently got a couple of beautiful pieces from ModCloth, this gorgeous blue duster that's kind of like a chiffon material. It's perfect for the fall, and I got it from ModCloth to pair up with some boots that they also sell that are these blue leather booties. I wore them together at a recent event. It looked great. I loved it. And I also got these really cute, blingy gold heeled sandals, which I can't wait to wear. Maybe the holiday season we'll be calling out for them. Now, you can get free sizing and fit and even styling help from their team of mod stylists, and they will help you effortlessly transition between seasons with summer styles that actually stay perfectly preserved for fall right now. So go to modcloth.com today and enter promo code 45th at checkout to get 30% off your order of $100 or more. That's 30%. So snag your next style obsession at ModCloth. Once again, go to ModCloth.com, enter promo code 45th at checkout, and get 30% off your order of $100 or more. Make every day extraordinary at ModCloth. Let's move on to basically what's been creating a lot of heaviness in our hearts for the last week, and that is the terrible, terrible shooting in Las Vegas. And I wanted to start by talking a little bit about Stephen Paddock. And who he was. He's the gunman in this case. He is the shooter. He is the lone wolf, and some would say he's the terrorist, depending on who you're talking to. So the information coming out about him, what's amazing about this is there's absolutely nothing to indicate. As somebody who's worked in CVE, which is countering violent extremism and anti-radicalization, and these, what researchers are always looking for, and law enforcement, is signs, indicators, right? What are the things that should, is it mental health issues? Is it domestic violence? Is it crazy radical ideas online? Is it, but they're not able to find a lot about this guy. So a little bit about him. He was 64 years old, apparently very wealthy, a millionaire, a multimillionaire, who made a lot of his money in properties, but also as an avid gambler. He gambled very, very heavily. He apparently had a girlfriend, but was not married, lived alone, didn't have any kids. His brother, Eric Paddock, who gave a really, his interview, I felt terrible for him because I thought it was really early on, and the media should have given him some time. He was just distraught. But he said, listen, my brother was just a normal guy, and he's never showed an interest in guns, which I thought was interesting because I thought maybe his family knows that this guy is a gun aficionado or something. He was an accountant. As far as he knows, he had no financial issues. And it doesn't seem like it is, because right before this happened, his girlfriend went back to the Philippines, and he sent her $100,000 over there, which means he has money, and a lot of it. And this guy says, like, you know, he has no military background or anything like that. And so his brother's like, where the hell did he get these automatic weapons?
And planned this attack. Military experts were probably more puzzled that not only did he have those weapons, but like the way he planned it out. I mean, with no military background, that's incredible right there. I mean, like, just the fact that how do you learn this stuff?
Right. And he was scoping out other areas, like, before he settled on this. He was scoping out, I think, in Boston and other.
Yeah, Fenway Park in Boston, a Chance the Rapper and Lord concert, I believe. It may have been Boston, might have been New York. I can't exactly recall. But it seemed like he was willing to just kill anyone, regardless of, you know, who they were, you know, what demographic they came from, what their political affiliations were, and he was just looking for massive carnage.
Right. Yeah, it didn't. There's just no indication about. I mean, although, you know, the usual suspects, ISIS and others, already went and like immediately claimed that this guy was one of them and that he converted. And there's like absolutely no evidence. But I just thought that they gave him this name, Abu Abd al-Bar al-Amriki, which is al-Amriki. Just pathetic. I mean, like, to me, that just shows how much of a decline. They're just so desperate. But anyway, intelligence and law enforcement's like, yeah, there's like totally no evidence for that.
And at the same time, it's like you can't completely rule out ISIS having an impact, because, and usually in the weeks that follow up, at least in the people that I've talked to, is that they present evidence, you know, video or audio, to confirm their claims. And of course, you know, ISIS has made claims that, you know, they did not actually do. But at the same time, there have been attacks that have happened that ISIS did not claim, but were ISIS inspired. And the people who, the terrorists who conducted those attacks, ended up having ties to ISIS.
That is true. That's true. I guess we wait and sit on that story. And if that pans out, I feel like the administration's response is going to be very different than the sober tone it took on this. And which was also kind of interesting, and I think we'll get to that in a bit. But what else do we know about him? We know that he was prescribed some anti-anxiety medications, but that's nothing. I mean, these are like, we're like reaching here, I feel like.
Wasn't he prescribed Valium?
I don't know. I think he was prescribed diazepam or something like that. Diazepam, which is an anti-anxiety drug that has like a sedative quality. And it says it can trigger aggressive behavior, but this was not like a trigger. This was planned out. And so I think it's not related to that drug use. And I also actually, I think it's kind of interesting how, it is important to figure out why this guy did what he did. But we are also, we spend a lot of time when certain kinds of perps are involved trying to figure out what is wrong in their personal lives and in their mental health. Without getting ideological. And so that's what's happening here. But it'll take time, I guess, before we get more information. But I was astonished when I heard about the number. And I think I was in Aspen for a board retreat at the Aspen Institute when this happened. And initially I thought this, you know, he maybe had a couple, because you can do a lot of damage with just a couple of guns, a couple of automatic or semi-automatic, you don't need, but he had an arsenal.
Yeah. 42 guns, I think, was the tally. He had 18 in his hotel room and then like 19 or so, 19 or 20, close to 20 in both. Maybe
in the hotel room, then back home.
Give or take.
Yeah.
He had some like bomb making materials. He had, you know, I can't recall the exact chemicals, but he basically, you know, he had a camera that was fixed in the food cart outside of his room to keep an eye on the hallway so that he would know what's going just right outside his room.
So before like law enforcement stormed his room, he would kill himself.
I think
that's why it was.
Or he would be prepared to take them out.
Which he didn't, because when
I know that, but I'm just saying, like, you know, I'm sure there's also the reports that he was planning on escaping and not killing himself.
Okay.
And that's the reason why I bring that up, because, you know, he probably had an exit strategy and it just backfired, so he decided to take his own life.
I mean, I don't... Okay, it's possible. I have no idea. I mean, I wonder how he thought he was going to, like, where he was going to go. Was he going to leave the country? I mean, did they find, like, travel documents? Did they find any evidence that he had tickets, that he had passports and a different name? Like, what? So I would need more evidence to be convinced that he had, like, a real strategy. I feel like he was ready to go down in a blaze of glory, which is a sign, by the way, of people who, like, are, like, ISIS affiliates. They go into this as suicide missions. Like, that's just how they do it.
I think the one thing, though, that kind of, that hurts that narrative is that one, he took his own life by shooting himself, not blowing himself up.
That's true.
He then tried to take out the police officers and, like, get shot doing so. He did it before they came in.
That's an important distinction because
that's not how ISIS fighters operate. They try to kill as many people before they go down.
Right. And they don't directly kill themselves because that would be completely un-Islamic. Versus killing lots of other people.
I mean, there are suicide bombers that believe that, you know, if you kill yourself but take out others, you are
then you're okay. Paradise. That's what they think, right?
But
right,
shooting yourself outright without killing, you know, anybody in that particular action of shooting yourself, I guess they feel is, you know, un-Islamic. Right.
So they're calling this the largest mass shooting in the history of the United States. Now that
modern history.
In modern history, right? Notwithstanding massacres. You're right.
You know,
you're right, though.
No, mm-hmm. I know. I mean, if we're going to talk history, obviously people are bringing up all the, you know, black and brown people in the early 20th century who were killed.
Huge massacres. Yeah.
Yeah. During massacres. And, you know, I don't know where we'd make the distinction between U.S. history and modern U.S. history. But if you want to talk about modern U.S. history within the span of, like, the last, you know, 40, 50 years, this has to be the biggest one.
There's that. And there's also the distinction of how it happened. I mean, some of these massacres we're talking about were carried out by state officials or mobs. And this is a very different phenomenon, right? Like, this is not, I would say it's not apples and oranges, but it's something different. It's slightly different, I think. But yeah, there have been extreme mass
59 confirmed dead and over 527, right. I believe, injured or wounded.
Terrifying.
Yeah, I don't know if there have been any other deaths since the shooting took place on Sunday, or at least since the numbers they got finalized. But
so you wrote about this after
I wrote a number of stories about this, and I can tell you Monday was just the longest day ever. As a journalist.
What were you, just reporting straight, or were you?
Yeah. So there were a few stories I was just reporting straight. And of course, since, you know, publication Red Alert Politics, you know, affiliated with the Washington Examiner and Weekly Standard, were conservative in the publication, you know, honestly, I did not try to find angles, to, like, twist and turn the story. I just honestly saw things, how they came in, and had to just take note and let people know, or let our audience know, what exactly was going on. And so, you know, President Trump delivered remarks on Monday morning around, I want to say 10:30 Eastern time. And it, you know, everybody was on Twitter trying to, like, you know, give their, you know, their take, their thoughts and prayers, their, you know, condolences, you know, calls for gun control. And then I saw President Trump's address, and, you know, I've been very critical of him for his entire presidency. However, there's one thing in the span of the last couple of months has probably been the most presidential and probably the best response I've ever seen that Trump give was to Las Vegas. And, you know, he called it an act of pure evil. He offered his condolences and attempted to bring a divided nation together.
In memory of the fallen, I have directed that our great flag be flown at half staff. I will be visiting Las Vegas on Wednesday to meet with law enforcement, first responders, and the families of the victims. In moments of tragedy and horror, America comes together as one, and it always has. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values. We call upon the bonds of citizenship, the ties of community, and the comfort of our common humanity. Our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence. And though we feel such great anger at the senseless murder of our fellow citizens, it is our love that defines us today and always will forever.
This quote kind of stuck out to me. We call upon the bonds that unite us, our faith, our family, and our shared values. We call upon the bonds of citizenship, the ties of community, and the comfort of our common humanity. And he then went on to say, you know, our unity cannot be shattered by evil. Our bonds cannot be broken by violence. And though we feel such great anger at the senseless murder of our fellow citizens, it is our love that defines us today and always will forever. Now, I'm sure a lot of his critics viewed his response as maybe tone deaf. I'm not 100% sure. I haven't seen a whole lot of criticism of his comments simply because, I mean, with the exception of maybe Keith Olbermann, who's, you know, former MSNBC host, now a correspondent with GQ magazine. He hates Trump. So that was the only thing, the only like major criticism is what I saw. But I thought it was...
I read some op-eds. I think I read one in The Atlantic that was critical, I'll explain why.
Yeah, but I just want to say, like, his response compared to what I saw from his 2016 opponent, Hillary Clinton, was just... It was like night and day almost, just because what I saw from Hillary Clinton, and I'll read what she wrote on Twitter. She wrote, and this is over the span of three tweets, so... she said, quote, Las Vegas, we are grieving with you, those who lost loved ones, the responders, and all affected by this cold-blooded massacre. The crowd fled at the sound of gunshots. Imagine the deaths if the shooter had a silencer, which the NRA wants to make easier to get. Our grief isn't enough. We can and must put politics aside, stand up to the NRA, and work together to try to stop this from happening again, end quote. Okay, so like, if you hear that in a vacuum after a shooting, you immediately think gun control. And that's what a lot of people were trying to move the debate towards immediately without even like trying to get down to the bottom of why this happened. The immediate thing was gun control. And we didn't know how this man got his guns. And she tweeted those on Monday morning. I mean, and for me, as someone who was, you know, very in favor of gun control at one point in my life to now being against it because I realized that there's very few things that can be done to stop mass shootings like these. And the fact that Hillary Clinton presented an argument about gun control with respect to silencers that actually would not do anything, like it was completely debunked, even by the Washington Post. If the shooter had a suppressor, and she uses the word silencer, but it's actually a suppressor, the suppressor would melt as a result of firing that many shots.
Anyway, all right.
Yeah. So, like, just so, like getting into that, and then the fact
there's
that she
a
says,
lot, there's a lot in my head right now, Siraj. I got to respond to you.
Hold on. I just want to say, and just the fact that she says we can and must pull politics aside, and then immediately says we got to stand up to the NRA. All right. How does those are two contradicting?
They actually aren't. They actually aren't, and I'll explain why. But here's okay. A couple of things. Now let's get back to the to Trump's remarks. The criticism of Trump's remarks is if anybody else. Like, whether it was GW, whether it was Barack Obama, if Clinton, if anybody else had delivered those remarks, they would seem sincere. These words, words like love, common humanity, these are completely antithetical to his nature. And this is the criticism that it is so, he looked insincere. These are insincere words coming from him. This is a man who incites divisiveness all of the time, depending on the situation. And these words do not ring true for him. And I think that's a criticism. And I think that's a fair criticism. Having said that, I guess he's kind of in a bind. He can beat Trump, which is obnoxious and rude and tone deaf, or he can try to be presidential, which he did here, but then it doesn't really, it's not authentic. So there's that.
But I mean, just to push back on that, I mean, even when he tries to be presidential, everybody views it as inauthentic because of what we know about.
Can I ask you something? Let me ask you something seriously.
Sure.
If Stephen Paddock was Mohammed bin Mohammed, okay, do you think it would have been the same remarks?
No, I think he would have immediately politicized it, and I would call him out on it.
So, right. And so that's the thing. So, you know, if you're going to be presidential,
I would just say that
be consistent.
I'm just saying, like, on the flip side, Hillary Clinton would be very opposed.
Well, let me get to that.
Politicizing it. She would not try to politicize
it. I cannot tell you how much it inflames me when people say this, now that dozens of people have died through gun violence, is not the time to talk about gun control. It is absolutely the time to talk about gun control, because you know what? When people are not getting killed by guns, we're not thinking about this. This only happens over whether, and all the families of victims in all of these situations, from Sandy Hook to, I mean, so many of the situations, over and over again say, like, it takes these tragedies to bring these issues to the front of the American, like, you know, like, discourse and consciousness. And so we have to think about these as opportunities to then, how do we change this? And it's, and I disagree that this is not a political issue. It's not political. Now, it's one thing that, yes, the GOP is completely aligned with the NRA, which is one of the most powerful lobbies in the United States. But people dying, you know, the kind of numbers in the United States, and I want to talk about statistics quickly, should not be a political issue. I don't think there's anything wrong with Hillary's response. I think she gave her condolences and she's like, our problem is we have too many goddamn guns out there. And I personally agree. Now, you said you used to be an advocate for gun control. Now you don't believe it. I want to just share some statistics with you, okay? And then I want you to explain to me, like, why, okay? Why you think that this is not an issue. And so some of these are coming from the BradyCampaign.org. And these are some, I think, horrifying statistics, okay? Every single day in this country, 46 children and teenagers are shot, okay? So every single day, 7 children and teenagers, I'm not even talking about adults, die from gun violence. Every single day in this country, 315 people in America are shot, okay, through guns. And we're talking about all kinds of gun violence, okay? Whether it's criminal, whether it's mass shooting, whether it's domestic, suicide, right? So 315 people die, 350 people are shot, 93 die a day. In this country, I mean, we have had more than 1,500 mass shootings since Sandy Hook. In this year, we have had one mass shooting a day. Okay, well,
what do you define as mass shooting, though? Three or more people?
Probably. I don't know if this, I don't know, like, what the legal thing. Definition,
I mean,
like, is.
I mean, we may have.
Does it matter? No, it doesn't matter, because three people is a lot.
If we define mass shootings as 50, you know, 20, you know, 10 or more people, you know, every day.
That's worse than three?
Well, yeah. That's more lives lost.
Okay, so three people a day in a mass shooting is not alarming enough.
I'm just telling you that the statistics that they use to define what a mass shooting is completely skew the narrative as to make it think like this happens as a daily occurrence, like what we see in Las Vegas, like we see in Orlando, like what we see in Sandy Hook.
Clearly, we're not talking about that level of violence because it's not even reported. And you're right. In fact, we think it's so insignificant, we don't even report it. But every day, there is something, you know, this is happening. Shootings are happening every day. 315 people are getting shot every single day in this country, one way or the other, sometimes with their own hands. Now, let's talk about the United States as compared to other countries, okay? We have 6 times as many homicides from firearms as Canada. We have 16 times as many as Germany. It is directly related to the fact that we have many, many more guns. We are 4.4% of the world's population, but half of the civilian-owned guns in the world are owned by Americans, okay? Now, one thing I thought was interesting is this. It's not that gun ownership is increasing. It's not that more people are getting guns in this country. It's a small percentage of people who own the guns, but they're just getting more and more of them, like this guy with his 42 guns. The average gun owner in the United States owns 8 weapons, okay? Now, the closest to any other country, when I say, I mean, like, Western nation, developed country in terms of, like, gun ownership that comes to the United States is Switzerland. Now, Switzerland actually has, they come closest to our level of gun ownership, but they have half of our level of gun ownership. Okay. Even there, though, regulations are really, really tight by our standards because, number one, all guns are tracked. By the way, we don't have such a system. We do not track our weapons. We don't have national or even state level registries.
We track automatic weapons.
What's that?
I said we track automatic weapons.
Okay. So what about semi-automatic? I mean, like, you know, and it's not hard to modify these weapons, which is what this guy did. He modified his weapon.
Right. But again, like that's, I mean, like just getting into that, you know, it doesn't bring up red flags for a lot of people to modify their weapons, at least for gun buyers and gun purchasers. You know, at least if you're able to acquire those type of, you know, people talk about like these automatic weapon bans. Like, that was the first thing that I think people were focusing on, was that they somehow thought that automatic weapons were legal when in fact they actually have not been legal since 1986. Right. And the modifiers is what probably makes them sound like or operate like automatic weapons, like what that bump stock that they were talking about.
I mean, I would argue that semi-automatic, you know, guns are also kind of dangerous too. I mean, I don't,
well, all
you know,
guns are dangerous, yeah, all guns are dangerous, considering the user.
But I want to get back to the Swiss example. Now, the Swiss example, they have much tighter regulations. Every single private sale is registered. But even then, even though they have half the ownership of us and they have much tighter restrictions than us, they still have much higher rates of gun death compared to their neighbors who don't have as many arms out on the streets. So there is absolutely some kind of connection between the number of guns in a country, like they're just out, owned privately, and the number of gun deaths. And I just think that's logical. I mean, it's like any other thing. You have more cars in the streets, you're going to have more people dying in cars in the streets, right? I'm like, so the more guns we have out in the hands of people, we are going to have more gun violence. And so we do have listeners, by the way, who we have listeners overseas. We have listeners from Australia and the UK, and thank you. I love you all, Canada. But I want to talk about the Second Amendment, because this is like the cornerstone of the argument for gun advocates.
Let's hear it.
Let's hear it.
Okay, let's bring it on.
Well, how do you understand it? I want to hear your response now to what I've just said, and then let's talk about First Amendment, the Second Amendment.
I mean, I know you listed a bunch of statistics, and you know every gun death is horrifying. I will say that 2/3 of gun deaths are actually happen by suicide. 1 in 5 gun deaths in this country happen for people between 15 and 34 years old, and they are usually at the hands of gang violence or random street incidents. And then you have the 1,700 women who are killed by domestic violence through guns.
I'm trying to figure out how this is making anything better. It doesn't matter if it's suicide or domestic violence.
I'm just telling you that there are what I believe needs to happen is specific tailored policies rather than a sweeping gun bill that would, you know, put a ban on all particular types of weapons. What really needs to happen is if you have people who are victims of domestic violence, the suspects or the convicts, I should say, or the perpetrators who commit those acts of domestic violence, you know, you can make a running list of people who commit these acts and ban them from purchasing guns. Of course, that does require, you know,
an actual conviction.
Absolutely.
And that's the problem, because most domestic violence is unreported. And the stuff that's reported doesn't always get convictions. So then what do you do?
Right. So, like, there's that problem. I think police need to prioritize victims of domestic violence, you know, obviously putting restraining orders on individuals who are, you know, either convicts or perpetrators. And with gang violence, I mean, how else do you address it without, you know, completely reducing regulations on the drug industry and legalizing most illicit drugs that are out there. And then, of course, you run into the symptom of that, which is more drug overdoses. And then for the suicides, how do you address that? 2/3 of gun deaths happen from suicide. Of course, you got to make, you know, discussing mental illness less of a stigma. You need to provide those people with counseling. I mean, there's no one easy solution for all of these gun deaths to go down unless you address them, you know, in a singular.
So I guess here's what I'm trying to figure out. The argument here is, if I'm saying, if gun control advocates are saying less guns is a solution, is the counter argument to that, well, if you take away the guns, then people will just hang themselves in the same numbers. Like, it won't be gun violence statistics. It'll be other ways that people hurt each other. It'll be stabbings. It'll be other methods of violence.
Let's be real here.
You know, children can't accidentally,
criminals do not respect the law. And if they want to carry out acts of violence, they're going to find a way to get their hands on any weapons of destruction, whether that be guns, whether that be a knife, whether that be a car or a bomb.
You're right.
So the question is,
how do we make it as hard as possible for those criminals to do that, right? Like, we still, despite the fact that criminals, I mean, by definition, break laws, we still have to have laws. So the question then, I mean, because here's what I think about. Nobody's talking about legislating to people who are like responsible gun owners. And by the way, that's another reason I'm saying this is not a bipartisan issue, is because like 90% of gun owners actually believe in tighter regulations. And even places like Nevada
They pass those restrictions, just like Stephen Paddock passed every single gun check, every single background check that he ever took.
Right.
And And the
which
reason,
is why they don't
and
work.
And there were no red flags. So how do you further legislate ourselves out of what I feel is a cultural problem in which people don't actually love and respect each other, whether they come from a different, you know, racial, ethnic, religious background, whether they believe in different politics. I mean, we're at the point where we're so polarized that people just don't see any other person who thinks differently from them as human. And so,
let's just pause here to talk about the culture. Now, I have been raised as an immigrant in this country, to understand that part of the culture of the United States, like this fierce individualism, includes gun ownership, the Second Amendment, right? Now, it's interesting as I learned more about this issue that this actually is kind of a modern construction, as gun manufacturers have become, you know, been able to mass produce weapons. It fits their narrative to say, hey, gun ownership is a very American thing. But I want to read the text of the Second Amendment. And I'm doing this specifically actually for Americans, but also for people who overseas who can't understand why the hell we are so obsessed with guns. This is what the Second Amendment says. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay. Now that Second Amendment was written in concert with another passage of the Constitution, which says this: the Congress shall have power to raise and support armies, but no appropriation of money to that use shall be for a longer term than 2 years. And then it goes on to say to make rules for government, regulation of land, to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union. Okay, so when you're talking about these militias, this was never understood, surprisingly, as an individual right. It was in 2009 that a court in the United States found that Americans have an individual right, that the Constitution actually is talking about an individual right to bear arms versus a right to bear arms vis-a-vis a militia that the government could call upon when necessary. That's actually the legal and historic context of the Second Amendment, not that the founding fathers feel like everybody should own all the guns they need. It was specifically in the context of assisting the U.S. government when they had to call on militias. And there was no individual right actually recognized. It was a collective and political right.
And the reason why they brought that up is to fight against a tyrant in the English kingdom. I mean, like we were already fighting a back against the British. And that really was like a provision to allow everyone who identified and, you know, supported the Union, the American Union, of, you know, fighting a back against the government. And I just want to say that because it's very interesting to hear how a lot of liberals are talking about gun control now, given the fact that they view Donald Trump as an authoritarian tyrant who is looking to infringe the rights of, you know, brown, black, oppressed communities.
LGBT. Wait, are you saying that liberals are saying we should take up arms now?
There are a lot of liberals who actually are. Yeah, statistics.
No, they are not.
Ever since Donald Trump was elected, black gun ownership has skyrocketed.
Right,
LGBT gun ownership has skyrocketed. You know, conservatives aren't buying guns now because they don't think the Second Amendment is under threat like it was under President Obama. It's for,
well, I will
for
say this.
Oppressed
I
communities.
Have long
for ahead, oppressed communities, like, the, you know, people who are, you know, racial, ethnic, you know, sexual orientation minorities, they feel oppressed. And so they're out there buying guns.
Well, I haven't seen, honestly, the statistics for that. And I personally don't know a single person who's bought a gun since the election. But I will say this, that I have long maintained that the way to get actually really strict gun regulation, although they'll find loopholes to this too, is for there to be like lobbies by people of color for gun ownership. The minute you have like Muslims for guns and black people for guns and all, like, we need our caucuses in the NRA, and then suddenly they'll be like, oops, the wrong people are exercising the Second Amendment.
I will happily lead the Muslim caucus for gun ownership.
How many guns do you own?
I own zero.
All right, then.
I mean,
great start.
I would own some, but I, you know, I'm not really that rich right now, and guns aren't really my priority. Also, I'm kind of a big guy, so I'm not really worried about violence being directed towards me.
Well, no matter how big you are, it's hard to stop a bullet. But I will
say
this. So
if I did get shot, I mean, you know, sure, why not? I'll take a bullet for anyone.
Well, look, if you are willing to lead that lobby for the specific purpose of undermining the NRA, I'm on board with you. I will also take it up. Speaking of which, I want to talk about the NRA.
I do have problems with the NRA. I do think they are, you know, with, you know,
crazy.
Wayne LaPierre and Dana Loesch. I mean, even in the weeks before Las Vegas happened, they have been pushing for, you know, divisiveness in terms of like instilling fear to make people think that Antifa, which is a very radical leftist group, and Black Lives Matter, which they, I think they've been co-opted by radicals, but the initial intent of Black Lives Matter, I thought, is good. But they've been
called Martin and Malcolm radicals back in the day, so I would have to disagree with you, but I have to say
I just want to say, though, that they've been basically pushing the narrative that they're looking to take over the country. And maybe Antifa is. I don't think Black Lives Matter is. But they're trying to use that as a narrative to try to get more people to buy guns because it helps their lobby. And
their ads are terrifying. And they also use terrorism as that. And I wanted to actually play the audio from this one ad that scared the crap out of me.
We need to get these weapons of war off the streets.
Well, these are weapons of war.
Stop making it easy as possible for terrorists to buy assault weapons.
We had an assault weapons ban.
Reinstate the assault weapons ban.
We have seen the devastation that these military-style weapons cause.
Let me say something to every political hack pretending you know an AR-15 from a double-barreled shotgun in the wake of the Orlando terror attack. Stop talking. Every word not only exposes your ignorance, but your utter contempt for ordinary Americans trying to survive in an age of terror you still won't fully recognize. Hillary Clinton says weapons of war have no place on our streets, and that we need to ban AR-15s immediately. Unlike Hillary, I've actually used an AR-15, but fully automatic. I was a SEAL for 12 years. Now I train average everyday Americans to protect themselves and their families. And for the vast majority of people I work with, there is no better firearm to defend their homes against realistic threats than an AR-15 semi-automatic. It's easy to learn and easy to use. It's accurate, it's reliable. And I guarantee if the Founding Fathers had known this gun would have been invented, they wouldn't have rewritten the Second Amendment. They would have fortified it in stone. Because they knew the only way for us to stay free was by having whatever guns the bad guys have. This firearm gives average people the advantage they so desperately need and deserve to protect their life, liberty, and happiness. But it isn't just the anti-gun politicians attacking our rights. With every broadcast, the media proves how ignorant and desperate for ratings they truly are.
Do we need AR-15s to hunt and kill deer?
So I've seen some of these videos, and the way, I mean, that one video that came out with, is it Dana Lesh is her?
No, it's Dana Lash.
Dana Lash. That was like, you know, it was that they want this and they want this and they want this. It was really, really scary. It was a scary video that came out a few months ago. And she's a spokesperson for the NRA. But these are very, very powerful. This is an extremely powerful lobby. This is not, you know, like they have a big impact. So when we're talking about culture, they're very much part of the culture that's helped us become a country that believes that America is all about, like it's an American value to own as many guns as possible.
And that's because advertisers have learned and news channels have learned that nothing sells better outside of sex than fear. And fear
and
sells so much, you know, fear sells. As soon as, I mean, go back to one.
It sells and it costs money too. They put a lot of money into their lobbying. The NRA spends tens of millions of dollars. I mean, like we're talking about close to like $70 odd million on lobbying versus like gun control groups, which have spent like, and I'm talking about like in the last almost 20 years have spent about $5 million. So they're like way outgunned when it comes to the money that the NRA is willing to pony up for Congress.
I mean, I just want to say though, that despite what the NRA has given to politicians, and I'm not trying to get into a fight about whataboutism, but Planned Parenthood has given $38 million to compared to $5 million that the NRA gave, and Planned Parenthood gave it
all. Not 5 million. I said 70 odd million.
70?
Yeah, 70 odd million since 1989.
Since 1989. Oh, yeah. Then it was $38 million in the last year that I'm citing. That
Planned Parenthood gave to who?
Democrats. Congressional Democrats.
How does Planned Parenthood have the money to do that?
Because
that's what I'm trying to figure out. Are you sure about this?
The taxpayer subsidized.
But they're not, they cannot make, they're not a lobby. Planned Parenthood is not a lobby that like operates in the way of the NRA, which is like a private organization.
Planned Parenthood is a private organization that accepts taxpayer subsidies and private donations, and they give it all to Democrats.
So are you saying Planned Parenthood is as dangerous as the NRA?
Well, if you if you view unborn babies as life, then yeah.
Were you part of our, I don't think you were part of, no, you weren't on the episode where we talked about Planned Parenthood when it was going to be defunded. Because, you know, the percentage of monies spent by Planned Parenthood on abortions versus like all of the other things that they provide for
I'm not doubting that.
Is a drop in the bucket.
I'm not doubting that Planned Parenthood.
And federal funding doesn't go towards any of it, by the way. But anyway, I also want to talk about the power that the NRA has in other ways. They, for example, I did not know this until I was really researching for this. But, you know, they have so much power that the NRA helped pass legislation that would, and this happened, I think, after Sandy Hook, prevent them from being liable in lawsuits, you know, which is different than a lot of other kind of consumer products that, you know, where the companies can be held liable for the use of their whatever they produce. This law, it was passed in 2005. It gives gun companies rare protection from any liability suits. They were able to do that. They were able to shut down CDC research into gun violence a long, long time ago. And that's pretty powerful.
Yeah, but I mean, if you look at, think of other tools of use that people have used to inflict violence. Let's look at cars, for example. I mean, if we ended up being able to sue every gun manufacturer for every death that happened by that gun manufacturer's hands, that opens up the floodgates into suing, say, for example, truck manufacturers that basically are used by ISIS to then, you know, plow into a group of people and kill them. That's just the type of precedent that we're setting if we're allowed to sue every gun manufacturer that produces that type of.
But isn't there a difference here? Because you're talking about a truck, which is normally not used as a weapon, versus a gun, which is only a weapon, right? I mean, like, they're producing weapons. Like, that is the only use of it. And, you know, outside of hunting, there's no other legitimate use of these weapons or in a war situation other than like hurting another human being.
I mean, I'll just say this, and it always relies on the user's intent. I mean, is the user's intent of having a gun to protect themselves for hunting or to kill as many people as they can? And so, you know, with cars and trucks, I mean, is their goal to, you know, get from point A to point B, you know, to make some money as a, you know, like Uber, Lyft, or, you know, taxi? Or is their goal to plow into a group of people and cause as much destruction as they can? You know, of course, I think the numbers are a lot slimmer in terms of people who operate cars and vehicles of that big versus actual guns. I mean, I'll concede on that point. But I think when it comes to individual liberty, you know, imposing and infringing the rights of people to own property is something that I'm against. And as well as I'm against the government telling us or telling its people what to purchase and what not to purchase.
How do you feel about marijuana?
About marijuana? Legalize it.
All right. At least you're consistent. Now I'm going to talk quickly, because we're going to wrap this up soon, about some of the fixes. And, you know, you mentioned earlier that, you know, how do you legislate yourself? How do you legislate out of a problem like this? And I think one very, very simple fix, it wouldn't be a complete fix, but a very simple response. And this actually would have made a difference. You said this guy, Paddock, passed all background checks. He bought his guns from different dealers in different states. But having a national registry, having state registries, because guess what? You can buy guns all over the place and nobody can, like, you cannot connect the dots. You can't say this guy's got like warrants or an arrest record in another state, because there's no registry that will match all that stuff up. So this guy comes in, he passes whatever that state level background check. That state level background check will not tell that gun dealer that this person has issues in other states, or he like has already bought 50 guns in other states. And you know what? One thing I learned recently, I thought this was really interesting, is the issue of bad apple dealers. Apparently, like 90% of guns that are used in crimes in this country can actually be traced to like a very small percentage of dealers. That's something like 5%. So, you know, let's take a look at them. And why are they at the root of like so many guns related to crimes? Let's like try to deal with them. But having a national registry, I think, is just common sense. And it doesn't infringe on the rights of people, but it puts in some checks.
Unfortunately, that's what no one else is talking about. And I agree with you on that. If there are bad apple dealers out there who are not doing what they're supposed to be doing, as they're mandated to by the law, they should not be selling guns. And if they're allowing people,
but I think they might be. I think they might be doing what the law is allowing them. I think where they are is that the laws are too lax in those places. Like you walk into a Walmart and walk out with this.
Well, you bring up the state, you know, state restrictions in terms of like not passing that information across state lines. I mean, that should be information that should be available to gun buyers and gun sellers.
Well, the NRA is the one that has opposed and blocked the creation of a national and state level registry on guns, and I think that's problematic.
No, I agree. I'm not saying it's not. I'm not saying I side with the NRA on this one. I think they're in the wrong, and I think there should be, you know, more information available to make it more transparent about who owns what in terms of. And this may be the most pro gun control that I've ever been in terms of that particular stance, but I don't think anyone should be restricted from purchasing a gun if they are able to pass every single background check that the government currently has in place. But I will say this, this doesn't stop, you know, straw purchasers who sell guns privately to people outside of going, you know, they basically subvert the background check process as well as borrowing and stealing guns. I mean, look at Adam Lanza. He stole all his guns from his mother and shot and killed her and then went and shot up everybody at Sandy Hook. And then,
well, like I said, it's not a complete fix, but I think...
No, telling you that even though we put these things in, even if we put these things in place, you still have San Bernardino who this, you know, the couple got their guns from their neighbor. And I'm just telling you, there's not a single fix at this moment that I can think of that will completely stop those mass shootings like we've seen in the past.
I think you're right. But I'll tell you what I think, why it's important to pass laws for many different reasons. Number one, are you going to see a reduction in certain kinds of violence? I think you actually will. But the second thing is this, passing laws, it's like a budget. These are moral signals. This shows, you want to talk about culture in the country? It will be a signal to the culture of this country that, listen, fine, gun ownership is enshrined in the Constitution, however you want to interpret it. But it doesn't mean that we don't have some kind of sensitivity towards the kinds of violence that can be inflicted. So, you know, I don't think the fact that people can subvert the law should prevent us from passing better laws. And I want to wrap up with this thing, and that is, what about Trump? This is the 45th. Let's talk about Trump. And people are calling Trump the wild card in the gun control debate. Where do you think he is on this?
I think, and, you know, I think in the past he's tweeted about imposing gun control. And of course, we haven't seen that as much of, you know, over the campaign. I think he's said about the keeping the Second Amendment alive and, you know, not infringing on people's rights to own guns. And, you know, I'm fine with that. I think after Las Vegas, he kind of hinted at the discussion over gun control and gun reform. But, you know, it's coming from a Republican president. And I think at this time, you know, with Trump, I think it probably was just a dodge to try to, you know, make sure the focus remained on the victims and away from the political discussion on gun control. If he happens to do something about it, that would be honestly a shock to me because he's not a traditional Republican. He's not, you know, even a conservative by many stretch of the means. But it's something that if the conversation and if the political winds shift in this direction where he has to address gun control, I think he actually might call for, I don't know, maybe something stricter.
Well, look, this
maybe
past April, he spoke at the NRA's annual convention, and he vowed to them that I will never infringe on your right to bear arms. He said, you came through for me, and I'm going to come through for you. He loves his loyalty.
Yeah.
He has rolled back some regulations from the Obama era that were supposed to help reduce gun violence. So, but you know, to me, he's never come across as somebody who... Like, I can't imagine Trump being a gun owner. Like, it doesn't seem like it. I think it's
He doesn't need to own a gun.
But I think it's a politically expedient issue for him. I think he could go either way on this.
Yeah, I mean, like, he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and wouldn't lose any voters. But it wouldn't be him shooting. It'd be his security detail. I mean, like, he doesn't need to lift up a gun. I mean, you know, there's a lot.
I'll be honest. I don't think this is going to go anywhere. I think every time something like this happens, it'll be the next. This is the largest mass shooting. It'll be the next one, and the next. I thought if there was ever a breaking point in this country on this issue, it would have been Sandy Hook. When Sandy Hook didn't do it, I was like, forget it. Nothing's going to do it. I really don't think so. I think, God forbid, there could be an incident in which 100, 200. I don't think it's going to matter.
as long as shooters are. Now, I do think it's interesting that if this guy was, let's say, a Muslim, immediately it would be the right time to talk about immigration. It would be the right time to talk about all kinds of other issues, but we never have the right time to talk about gun control.
And I agree with you. I mean, and even if they politicized the shooting, if the guy was Muslim, I would be in the same camp as you, and I'd be like, this is not the time to talk about immigration. But, you know, even the shooting of Steve Scalise in June, it was James T. Hodgkinson, shot up a congressional baseball practice. I think there was a conversation about gun control. I can't really recall now because, you know, months seem like years to me now. And but even after he was shot, I don't think Steve Scalise really changed his approach on guns, if anything.
It wasn't a mass enough shooting, I think, to trigger the national conversation,
died,
maybe.
Obviously, but he was very close to death.
Right. All right. So we're going to wrap up this this conversation. Thank you so much, Suraj, again, for being with us this week. I love having this. I mean, you bring so much to the table, and I don't always agree with you, but I do respect your opinions. And I'm personally fascinated. I one day want to hear about your evolution, because I know you were not always a conservative, and I want to hear about your evolution on some of these views at some point. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about that. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will be back in a week. Have a great week.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible, and I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products, and thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan. We have been produced by Long Arc Digital Media, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. And guess what? You can even leave us a voice message. Call us at 202-670-8345. And you never know, we might just play your message on the air. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.